We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey everyone, welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a great return guest back from the early days of Perpetual Chess, a young-ish chess talent, teacher, writer, coach, international master, player, of course, Kostya Kovutsky. Kostya, thanks for joining us again.
Hey Ben, thank you for having me again as well.
So for those of you listening who haven't been listening to Perpetual Chess since the days of way back in January of 2017, Kostya graciously was our fourth guest, and he basically told his whole life story chess-wise up to that point. So if you're newer to the show or you didn't catch that episode, you can go back and get all of Kostya's background. You also may know him. He's quite active on social media, and he does lectures for Chess University. He has a Patreon page. He makes YouTube videos. He writes for US Chess, and he can even be found actually teaching in chess clubs and stuff like that. So you may already know him, but if you don't, you can get a lot of background. But I want to pick things up and find out what's new. So how's life, Kostya?
Life is pretty good. I'm currently at home in Mountain View, kind of getting back into the school year starting up. So there's a lot of coaching going on here.
Yeah, I'm there with you. And we thought that now would be a good time to get you back on because you came back from one of those summer chess trips that make me so jealous. So you've been covering this on your YouTube channel. You've been doing game reports and talking about it a bit online. But why don't you let our listeners know first, if you could just give a rundown of all the places that you went this summer.
Yeah, absolutely. I went on a huge trip. It started in Hungary for GM Norm round robin tournament, and that was back around the middle of June, like June 12th. And then the trip lasted all the way until just recently, the first week of August, where it finished with an IM Norm round robin in Montreal, Canada. That was kind of my final event So in between these two tournaments, I also played an open tournament in Romania, Fisca Open. Here I met up with Eric Rosen. And then from there we went to Barcelona. And from Barcelona we went to Benasque, Spain, and played the Benasque Open. That was a really strong event. From there, I then traveled to Chile to coach at the Pan American Youth Festival, where I was working with the U.S. team. This was probably the event I was most looking forward to, because I've wanted to coach at one of these events for a while. But yeah, that basically takes us to late July, and then I took a flight to Montreal to play this I Am Norm round robin, where I was one of the IMs.
Nice. So three continents and four or five chess tournaments, plus some coaching thrown in. Sounds like a fun summer to me. And did you get some downtime in between? Did you get to do some actual touristing?
Yeah, we had a couple of days that were mostly used for travel. But I would say the highlight would be just quickly going through France in between the tournaments in Spain and Chile, as I was flying from Paris. So I was able to travel to Bordeaux and see that place for the first time. And then we went to this very small French town on the seaside called Cap Ferret, which I thought was really, really beautiful and a great place.
Sounds good to me, yeah. And did you get to sample the Bordeaux in Bordeaux?
No, I'm not much of a wine drinker, so I didn't really take advantage.
What a waste.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to the chess. So how did the, and I do want to talk about your coaching as well, but let's start with your playing. So how did you feel like you performed?
So in general, I think I did reasonable. I got a plus score in every tournament, and my best result was probably in Romania in the small open, where I tied for first with 7.5 out of 9. But that tournament, I basically played down every round. So it was more of a matter of like not getting nicked too many times and trying to pick up as many wins as possible. In my first event, that was the GM Norm round robin. I think I lost my chances pretty early on, just a couple too many draws and a loss. But that was my first tournament where I'm actually playing one of those round robins for a GM norm. So that was kind of interesting to see like the level of the playing field and how I need to perform to actually score a 2600 performance. I would say my play definitely started to suffer by the third tournament, I would imagine due to just fatigue from playing so much. But I definitely felt it in Spain, where I generally had a good tournament, but then I had like three draws against lower rated players from much, much stronger position, like big, almost winning advantage. And so clearly felt like I ran out of steam and not being able to convert those positions. Then I was really worried about how I'd play at the final tournament in Montreal, because the tournament's organized by my friend Lefong Hua, and he mainly organized the event to give some of the top Canadian juniors a chance to play against strong players and play in a serious event. So I knew going in that they would all be like preparing very seriously and it'd be really, really tough. And Canadian players are famously underrated because they have kind of a small circuit up there, and so everyone's playing against each other and their feed 8 stays a little bit low. So I was really worried about just tanking and losing a ton of points there. Fortunately, I did okay. I finished, I think, tied for second with 5 out of 9. Ended up dropping only a few points, but I felt like that tournament was more like damage control, like not getting upset too much.
Yeah, a lot to follow up on from there. So one thing that that comes to mind is, so I've heard that about Canada, and I also hear China and India get mentioned as places where the players are underrated. Without necessarily calling out a country, are there places that you hear the people are overrated?
That's a good question. I feel like it's all kind of relative. So I would say nowadays, if someone is overrated, it just means that they're rated at like the appropriate rating. So it just means like you're getting, I guess, like a fair win-loss against them, versus playing players that are underrated is, of course, can be frustrating if you're doing it over and over.
Well, but for some people to be underrated, don't others have to be overrated?
No, I think it's just a matter of them like not having like caught up with their actual strength.
Okay.
They just simply haven't played enough games.
Yeah.
At least that's the case, I think, for Chinese and Indian players.
Yeah, and you hear that even about Scholastic American players, the up-and-comers, because not all events are FIDE rated. But yeah, I was just curious. So getting to the events, do you feel like do you feel like this gives you new respect for people who play and travel all the time, or did you already have that respect, or did you feel like this is you're saying that you may have run out of gas? Do you feel like that was sort of a one-off thing and not something that would necessarily happen with every trip with so much chess?
You know, I've definitely felt fatigue before, because I've done a few of these trips where I play just multiple tournaments in a row. I think it's a very real thing, and yeah, I think it is one of the things I have to kind of work on if I want to like continue improving and taking my game to the next level. Because some of these GMs, they travel a lot, and then they have to just, you know, put their maximum effort in every single game, like regardless of how tired they are, because it's, you know, it's how they make a living. So yeah, I imagine it's very hard to achieve that, but I think it's important to work on that consistency and maybe just on physical fitness simply.
Okay. I mean, you seem like you're in reasonable shape.
I don't know. I guess when I travel, I do a lot of walking, but other than that, I wouldn't say anything.
Okay. So not doing the hardcore cardio or the ultra marathons or anything like that.
Yeah. Not so much.
Yeah. And it does seem to be important, for these long games, especially. So you felt overall like your performance was okay. Was there a lesson that you felt like, was there a particular aspect of your game that you came away feeling like you need to work on?
Yeah, definitely the technique, the converting of positions. You know, I think where you have like a pretty serious advantage at this point, it's like that should be as close to 100% as possible, especially against like low rated players. So I think that was kind of, to me, that seems like the main thing I would have to work on at this point.
So how will you do that?
Mainly through reading. I try to do a lot of reading when I'm kind of studying and working on my own chess. I haven't picked out, let's say, I don't know, the right book, but there are a lot of books on like technical chess, or even just studying the games of someone like Karpa, for example,
right,
might do me wonders.
Yeah, or Carlsen for that matter.
Yeah, Carlsen, absolutely.
So you mentioned that you need to work on your technique, Kostya. Is that something that you had an inkling of even before this, or did this trip really just drive it home?
Yeah, I think I could definitely pick this out before the trip as like my number one concern. So all the games from the trip, they basically kind of like confirmed that conclusion. But it was still a great experience, and I always feel like I learned a lot, not just from playing, but, you know, you always do like 2-3 hours of prep before the game, and I feel like you learn a lot there. And then I was doing these game analysis videos from each trip. A bunch of them with Eric Rosen were put on his YouTube channel, then my YouTube channel. But basically, this is something I started doing a couple years ago, just doing the video analysis, because I felt like, number one, it would just force me to analyze the game in detail right away. So I would try to gain as much as I could from it. And then putting it online is kind of like the old Butvinnik method, where, you know, you have to publish your analysis so people can critique it. So you can't just superficially analyze the game without really going into detail if you're going to publish it for everyone to see. So, yeah, I feel like apart from what I learned just by like studying the openings before the game. I think there was a number of just like really, really interesting positions where I like misplayed it in some way. And it's just like a clear indication that, you know, I wasn't evaluating certain positions correctly.
Well, good information to have, even if you don't always get it like the way you want it. And for listeners who haven't seen Kostya and Eric Rosen's videos this summer, all of Kostya's recap videos are great. I've been watching them since he started doing them. He's also done them in the past with Isaac Steinkamp when they were in Iceland together. And Eugene Perelstein, Grandmaster Perelstein, hopped in on a couple of them. And I'm very partial to the longer YouTube recaps because I just feel like I enjoy the little 10 and 15 minute quick hitters of a game, but basically you're just going to learn a tactic or two. But to really see a stronger player take their time and go through their thought process to me is like a great way to learn, and one that wouldn't have been available before the digital era. So thanks for taking the time to make them. I know that they're quite time consuming to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that. I think the deeper analysis, if someone has the patience for it, it can be really interesting to follow. And we do try to explain as much of the thought process as we can, because we know that's what people kind of find most interesting.
Yeah, and it's warts and all. I mean, of course, you're much stronger than me, but you still, like, you'll have things that you miss, and I can benefit from seeing things that, like, you or Eric Rosen or Eugene or whoever missed, because I'm missing even more. So to see, like, that no matter where you are, these are the struggles you deal with is quite helpful. Although, Kostya, I do have to admit, so I had seen every one of your videos up until this summer, but you played so much chess that you finally outpaced me. So I'm... I made it up to like somewhere in Banask, but but I've got some catching up to do.
Yeah, that's fine.
But I really do enjoy them. It's just, as I said, I mean, all the time it takes him to make them, and they're 45, 50 minutes a pop, and like both he and, if he has another player in the video, which he usually does, going over their games, 25, 30 minutes of analysis. So it's a great way to really immerse yourself and pick up some opening tips and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, the hard part is usually just the rendering of the video and the uploading, because sometimes we're in a place where the Wi-Fi is real spotty. Like in Spain, it would take multiple hours to upload the video to YouTube, and that was usually the big time consumer.
Right. Yeah. And can you I upload these interviews to YouTube, so I have a little bit of experience with it, but the internet's okay here, and even then, it takes longer than other stuff. But can you upload it and leave where you're staying and go do stuff, or do you feel like you kind of need to stick around for that?
That's usually what I would end up doing, but then the Wi-Fi would cut out and the upload would either fail or slow down.
Yeah, I was afraid that something like that would be the answer.
Right, so it was like a lot of babying the laptop.
Right.
But yeah. Okay, we looked around it. We just took it to places with decent Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's a pain though. And what's going on? Like, so you're a very busy chess professional, as we mentioned in previously. You have many roles, but you've been vocal in the past about, you know, you worked hard, as we talked about in your first interview, to get the IM title, and you had just gotten your last norm when we talked, and you've been talked in the past about wanting to get a GM norm. So, are you still finding time to, with all the teaching that you do, work hard on your own chess?
I think it comes in cycles. Like if I have some events coming up, then I'll definitely dedicate a lot of time in the weeks before to either like refresh my openings or do some calculation work, something kind of like really challenging. During the main part of the year, I'm usually just focused on teaching, and I don't do a whole lot of training on my own. But one thing that I try to incorporate is when I teach, I do try to use like new material as often as I can, so that it just kind of stays interesting for me, and that I'm also just like learning a lot while I'm preparing lessons for my students, many of whom are, you know, not that strong, but can be up to like 1600, 1800. So they're at the level where they can be, you know, seeing some, you know, really interesting chess games that are also pretty interesting for me to see as well. So I do feel like I get to work a little bit during the year, and then ramping up, I try to do more and more.
Okay. And do you find the new source material just from keeping your database updated or reading online periodicals, or what's like, how do you find this material?
Well, a lot of times it's just taken from like the latest games. You know, Chess24 will always publish like the funny blunders and nice tactics. I mean, that's an easy way to get new material, but that's usually not super deep. It's just kind of like one funny idea. So I like to work a lot with books. I think books just have probably everything, you know, a player needs at this point to get to any level they want. So I'm a big believer in just like having my students read books and then working with them and just having them absorb, you know, as much material as possible.
And do you give your students homework?
Yeah, as much as they can handle. It's usually like I want them to kind of want to do it themselves. So I never believe in like forcing them to do anything. So we always just kind of negotiate and figure out like, you know, what's doable for them, given that they have tons of schoolwork and other, you know, extracurricular activities as well.
Gotcha. Of course, you know, I was going to ask you about chess books anyway, so I might as well ask you now. Do you have any books that you find yourself recommending over and over again to your students?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have always been a fan of books that incorporate some culture, some history, or like even stories. So for that reason, I've always really enjoyed the Kasparov books, My Great Predecessors. I think those were, I mean, just some of the best books out there. I also like other books. For example, this one book is called From London to Elista. I don't know if you've heard of it, by Yevgeny Bereyev.
Yes, it's a match book, right?
Yeah, it's basically following the three of Kramnik's world championship matches against Kasparov, Leko, and then Topalov. And then it's written from the perspective of one of his seconds, and I thought it was just a super interesting book. I mean, the analysis of the games was really cool, but also just seeing like reading the behind the scenes info, I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, that's like right up my alley as well.
Yeah, and if anything, I mean, it just like motivates you to work more on the game, which I think is, you know, really, really useful in itself.
And are your students, is that a book that you mentioned a lot of students in the 1600s, 1800 range, is that like over their heads, or are they able to follow a book like that?
No, I usually recommend this for higher level, for players that are already, let's say, maybe like preparing for games, you know, have their own kind of like opening work. So for this level, I think it's probably a little too high level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would say for lower rated players, there's one book I really like by Johan Hellstein called Mastering Chess Strategy.
Yeah, favorite of Greg Shahadi's, and I think a couple other people have mentioned it too. It is really good.
Yeah, I mean, it's a total behemoth. I mean, it's a very large book, but the amount of material and exercises in it is really comprehensive.
Cool. And speaking of coaching, so you mentioned that your favorite experience over the summer was coaching the youth team in Chile. So what was it about that experience that made it so enjoyable?
Yeah, so I've you know, always been interested in working at some of these high level youth events. I really like doing opening work and opening preparation. And working with like, you know, some of the best kids in the country is always interesting to see, you know, how they're playing and how they're kind of developing as chess players. So this was my first time working with the U.S. team. I was basically invited by the U.S. delegation, and head of delegation is Avi Friedman, who's been doing this for quite a while. And I was working with two coaches that have also been there for many years, IMs Armin Ambartsumian and Andronik Medikosian. So I actually grew up with them because we were all in Southern California together. So I've played Andronik, you know, like 10 or 15 times when I was like working my way up as a chess player. And in the past, I've even worked with Armin, as he doesn't play anymore, but he's just a very high-level coach. And he helped me a lot with my chess. So it was really cool to work alongside them and now prepare, you know, some of the best kids in the nation.
Yeah, it sounds great, if a little intimidating with how good the kids were. So, or how good the kids are. So what age kids were you guys coaching?
So the competition was all ages 8 through 18. The way it worked out is that all six of my kids were on the younger side. So I had, I think, one kid under 12, four kids under 10, and one kid under 8. And I ended up getting, in my group, two of the kids ended up winning silver medals, which was really great. They were definitely one of the highest rated players in their sections, and I think one of the strongest, but it's such a long event. I mean, 9 rounds for the kids. I think many of them, if they haven't played an event like this before, it's very grueling. I mean, you really have to just like play your best chess every single day and try to get nicked as little as possible.
Yeah, the high-level scholastic tournaments are sort of their own animal. I mean, I remember both as playing way back in the day and as a coach, like you see a lot of kids whose performance can be highly erratic.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's good if the kids can, sometimes playing to their level is an achievement, especially, as you say, if you're one of the higher seeds. So I know we've had some other guests who've done some youth, like high level youth coaching, like GM Robert Hess comes to mind, and he talked a bit about what his approach is at events like this. So how did you find yourself approaching getting these kids ready? Like, was it a lot of opening prep or more sort of mindset stuff? What do you think is most important at a tournament like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think I talked a little bit about my philosophy on openings the first time we talked, where I basically suggested that your goal from the opening should always be to get a playable position where you know what your like long-term strategic plan is, you know what your concrete short-term goals are, you're familiar with some of the tactics in the position, and you definitely understand what your opponent is trying to do and how you're supposed to try to, you know, make that less achievable for them. So I felt like that approach is really useful when you have limited time to prepare, which is definitely what happened at this event. I don't know how it's been like in other events, if they're stretched out a bit more, but this one was pretty compact. We had a couple like double round days, and the morning rounds were pretty early. So maximum I would have like 30 minutes with a student, but it was usually more like 10 to 15. So a lot of work was actually done by the parents, because they're all at this point familiar with how to look up opponents' games and figure out their openings, and use ChessBase and download games and all that. So a lot of the work was done by them, just like compiling games, emailing them to me, so I don't have to do that work for like each student. And then it was a matter of just kind of like, you know, going into it, I did a quick lesson with them just so I could kind of learn what the repertoire is already. Then when we would look at the opponent's games, we would just kind of figure out, okay, do we want to go for the normal stuff or try to prepare, you know, something new? And I basically just tried to get a feeling for each student, like how comfortable they were to play a new position versus just play what they're already familiar with. If it was more on the latter side of the spectrum, if they didn't really want to try new things, then it was a matter of kind of like patching up potential holes in their repertoire and making sure that, you know, they're not vulnerable to prep somewhere. As far as the psychological side goes, I mean, I went with just the basic notion that staying positive is good. And I just tried to pep them up a little bit, telling them that, you know, they're strong enough to beat whoever they're playing, that they can, you know, get a good position from the opening and then take it from there. So I feel like overall their confidence level was pretty good. But a lot of that, I mean, these players are pretty experienced at this point, so I don't think I had to help too much in this regard.
Okay. Yeah. So primary emphasis on openings, it sounds like. Do you consider yourself, I mean, I having written a book on the Open Sicilian, the Modernized Sicilian, and since I support your Patreon page, I know I think I know the answer to this, but I should ask you anyway. Do you consider openings to be like a strength of yours generally?
Yeah, I think I would say I'm pretty knowledgeable, you know, honestly, not so much on opening theory so much, because I would say I don't know a lot about, you know, many different openings, but rather opening structures and certain types of middle games and what's a good version of this and what's kind of like less appropriate. So I feel like that makes me very flexible regardless of what openings are going to show up on the board, like e4 or d4. I have some, you know, some knowledge in playing like a lot of different kinds of positions.
Which makes you, I'm guessing, a good person to be coaching these kids.
Yeah, exactly, because they have such wide-ranging repertoires.
And did you find that the kids were facing or giving a lot of surprises, or was a lot of what you guys prepared coming up on the board?
There were definitely a few moments I recall where we did get a surprise, like the opponent is only playing one variation their whole life and all of a sudden they're playing like completely different opening. Mm-hmm. So of course there's like nothing you can do there that's going to happen. Usually I try to include somewhere in the pep talk that like if they play something different, they're not going to know it as well. So, you know, you'll have chances there as well. But there are also a few times where the opponent kind of like waltzed into what they normally do or what we can kind of predict. And then I'm sure the student felt very confident there.
Yeah, it's getting easier and easier to workshop openings in private now with all the online stuff and computers and so on. So I'm glad some of it paid off, and I'm sure it cut both ways. You caught people off guard, and you know your students also got caught off guard. So for all the weekend warriors listening, the chess enthusiasts who play when they can, like, what advice do you generally give for them in terms of preparing for a player? Like, people are always debating how much to prepare versus how much to try to stay fresh. So in like a weekend Swiss, what do you think is the best approach?
Usually you're going to have really limited time, especially for like the second round of the day. If you finish late, you have to eat, and then, you know, the pairings are always posted late anyways, but like maximum, you know, you're going to have like 15 to 30 minutes with the pairing. I would say like I usually actually would opt for the side of like resting more in an open tournament, because there's very little preparation someone can do in that amount of time anyway. So if your openings going into the event are solid, you know, max what you should do, I would say, is maybe check one of your previous games to make sure that no one can repeat it and catch you if you're in trouble in round one. I usually tell players just to rest up for the game, because the repertoire is good enough. They should be able to handle, you know, whatever is thrown at them in like this 5-10 minutes of preparation.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's good advice. I mean, I think everyone has the temptation to sort of, it's like cramming for a test, but right. I think it's just as likely to be counterproductive. Okay, another question, chess improvement question from supporter of the podcast, Chris Wainscott. So Chris asks, when you're analyzing one of your games, is there a particular way you go about it? For example, do you start at move one and go to the end, or analyze the critical moments first, etc.? Also, how much time should be devoted to analyzing a normal game, say, for example, a 40-move game without a ton of complications or blunders? So how much time should you spend on a game? I feel like my cadence made that question confusing.
Sure. Time-wise, I would say, like, you know, during a tournament, if you have limited time, then you should just check the opening and make sure you have some improvement there. After the event, I think if it was a serious game, you should spend quite a considerable amount of time. It probably takes me on average like 3-4 hours per game, because I also, in addition to kind of like trying to analyze it deeply and trying to figure out like where I miscalculated and what variations I misjudged, you know, I also take the time now to annotate the games, and that takes a lot of time as well. In terms of how I analyze the game, I mean, a lot of times there might be one moment like at the end where you just want to know like, okay, was there a win or not, or was there a draw? Other than that, I basically just kind of start from the beginning and just start working through like the different lines I considered and what I thought might happen and if I thought that was good for me, was that actually good for me, or, you know, would they have some defense? Actually, one game I didn't mention, but I had a game in Hungary where I agreed to a draw in the final position. It was a king and pawn end game where we both have two connected passed pawns. So to me, it felt like just an immediate draw. So I accepted a draw only to find out that the position was winning.
Huh.
And the way I found that out was kind of funny. I just finished playing with my opponent. It was like a 16-year-old kid. We went outside to analyze, and then his parents walked in and then just basically told us, like, oh, yeah, you are winning in the middle position. So I had no idea. I assumed the game was dead drawn at that point. But that was another moment where I felt like, yeah, maybe a grandmaster would have taken an extra 2 minutes just to double check that the position was drawn. Cause I think finding the winning line there was pretty doable for me.
That's interesting. I'd like to see that position.
Yeah. If anyone's curious, it was, my game with Black against, Dominic Horvath.
Okay.
I think it likely went into the database, but if not, I can send you a link and you can post it up.
Okay, yeah, I'll try to track it down. That would definitely be interesting to see. And you mentioned, so in a critical moment where you want to know if it's a win or a draw, and you might skip right to that. Of course, mm-hmm. I have to ask you if you look with an engine after the game, or if you just go to the position and, you know, try to find your way through it on your own.
I actually, sometimes I do a mix of both. Like, I feel like if I have a really good position strategically and I kind of like let it slip and I misplay it, then I try to kind of work it out myself just to see if I can find it later. And I'll even think about it like, you know, blindfold during dinner or something, kind of the typical case. And then I feel like if I can figure out the solution, then it kind of feels nice. It's like, okay, I kind of worked it out myself. And then I'll check with the engine to kind of confirm or see if, you know, I missed something. But then there are a lot of cases where it's like you're at the board and you're just like calculating very intensely and like, you know, there's a solution or you know there's something to be found. And then you kind of just want to know because you figure like, okay, you already put in your maximum effort here. You didn't figure it out. So now let's just like check the engine and see what it says. And that's just to like save yourself the time suffering over it.
Okay. Yeah. So you're willing to do either one depending on the circumstance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I've talked about this with other guests, but that makes me feel a little better because I certainly know the feeling of the latter where you just have to know. And you know, usually my instincts are right. If you feel like you missed something, you probably missed it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And for listeners, interested in seeing Kostya's analysis, I've mentioned his Patreon page a couple times. So he goes in incredible analysis on his games and, you know, shares all of his opening prep and really posts videos. I recommend you check it out. It's a cost-effective way to improve your own chess and get a glimpse at how a stronger player approaches things. And you had a post recently involving chess computers. So mm-hmm. I had mentioned that I wanted to ask you about this. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this interesting post and subsequent or related video that you did?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, for my Patreon, it's kind of just like taking what I do in the real world and then trying to share some of it online. So when I'm playing in tournaments, then I'm obviously going to be analyzing my games a lot. I like to share that. And when I'm at home, I'm doing more like studying and research. So I might like put up more like interesting positions that I'm looking at. But for this one, it basically happened during the analysis of one of my games from Spain. I was analyzing the position with Stockfish, and it was one of those King's Indian positions where Stockfish tends to give just a really huge advantage for white, like plus 1.3, 1.4. And I think it's mainly because it's like a close center and has a big space advantage, so the evaluation just like goes way up. And it can be frustrating to work with because you don't really know if that's the actual valuation of the position, like or if white is just like slightly better and the engine's overvaluating it. So I turned to Komodo to see how he's going to evaluate the position, because they typically have a different evaluation. And Komodo was saying like plus 0.3, plus 0.4. So like a huge difference in evaluation, like plus one. So I felt like, okay, clearly when this happens, usually one of the engines is kind of like missing something, or like really is overvaluating or under evaluating something. And so I just started like doing some analysis and like just like pitting the engines against each other. I used my laptop as a second computer, and I would run the engines on the different engines on different computers and see how they spar against each other. And yeah, eventually I found out that Stockfish was kind of more correct in that position. White had a lot of like dynamic chances that Komodo was missing. So I just felt like that whole exchange was so fascinating that I recorded a video kind of showing the analysis and put it up.
Yeah, it was super interesting to me. I mean, your knowledge of chess computers was clearly deeper than mine. And so one thing I was wondering based on the video is, how big a difference does the processing speed of the computer make, in your opinion, both from this little experiment that you did and your general experience working with computers?
I think it's pretty important just from a like mathematical standpoint. So for listeners, the background is that my desktop computer is probably three and a half times stronger than the laptop. So usually,
processing speed.
Yeah. So for me, in practical terms, usually means that like if I analyze anything on my laptop versus the desktop, I know to kind of, I should run it like at least three times longer than I would normally, just so I can get kind of an accurate, you know, estimate of whatever I'm looking at. But I think the power of the engines, of course, has increased dramatically. So I remember seeing some article on chess.com that it basically had Komodo playing like on a smartphone against an older engine playing on a much more powerful CPU, and Komodo was just like killing it. So I think in terms of playing strength, I think the engines have, at least from what I understand, increased dramatically. You know, maybe just knowing what lines to prune, just knowing how to evaluate positions a little bit better. You know, whatever they've done, they've done a great job.
And have you ever come across this before, like such a disparity between two engines when analyzing your games?
You know, I usually don't take the time to use or to consult two engines. I usually just stick with Stockfish. In the past, I used Houdini, which I really liked. But yeah, sometimes if the evaluation is really confusing to you, it just makes sense to like get a second opinion, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And what about, I know in our first interview, you mentioned you'd worked with Varakopian among other coaches. Do you still work with coaches in your own quest to improve?
I've worked a little bit. So when I was training hard to get that final IM norm, I spent a lot of time working with Alshan Moradi Abadi.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that basically just happened very, very naturally. We had just become friends a few months earlier, and then we played once, and then it was kind of like a natural partnership for him to start coaching me a little bit. He had specifically wanted to work with stronger players, so it was kind of a good fit. Other than that, I kind of slowed down just because I felt like there's so much I could be working on just from books and so much I haven't done yet that it doesn't make sense to spend time and money with a coach if I'm not kind of like doing the things on my own already.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I slowed down in that sense, but I have continued, training and sparring with other players and such.
Yeah. You've got a pretty good network in the chess world. Do you have like a, like if you had all the time in the world to study chess, like every competitive chess player's dream, like what would you do? Say you got the Sanford tomorrow.
Right.
what would you do over the next year? What would your plan be?
I think it would be pretty simple. So I would first just read my great predecessors from cover to cover, just to get the full picture of like chess history and chess culture and all the best games that, you know, were played by the previous champions.
And sorry to cut you off, but have you read it in the past?
I've just read certain sections of it. So I read the part on Fischer and Hrushevsky and some of the previous chapters, kind of just like, you know, whichever players I was most interested in. So I think I read about Alekhine and a few other guys.
Okay.
Other than that, I would probably just get all of Agard's books in the GM preparation series and just solve every problem in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would keep you busy for sure.
Actually, as another book recommendation, I, you know, really enjoyed the Excelling at Chess series, which is kind of a prelude to the GM prep series, especially just the first book, Excelling at Chess, which was just written about kind of more general, like how to approach the game type stuff, which I thought was a very, very interesting read.
Okay.
And the more recent one, I guess the follow-up to that, Thinking Inside the Box, I read right before the trip, actually, and I thought this was just a very, very nice, like, practical guide. It's like everything a player needs to do to hit the next level.
Cool. And is that, I mean, those books are, Agard's books are very commonly recommended. Everyone raves about them. Do you think that they're good for players of all levels, or more oriented just for stronger players?
Well, I think the different books have been written for the different levels. I would say the Excelling at Chess series is kind of like the starter one. So I recommend a lot of these books to students that are like 1500, 1600.
Okay.
Because like the calculation book, for example, like goes into and it like explains the mechanics of calculation and a lot of the different techniques like comparison and method of elimination and all that stuff that's like very like fundamental.
Okay, so yeah, I'll put all these books up on the webpage where it lists all the book recommendations. So moving on to another topic, Kostya, I've quoted you on the podcast at least once talking about how much you learned and benefited from Peter Lecoq's announcing. But since we have you here, I feel like we might as well hear it straight from the source. So you wrote a really insightful post on Patreon about it, on your Patreon page. What was it about his analysis that you found so interesting? And well, let's start with that.
Yeah, well, so I've always enjoyed watching commentary. And when I was like 1700, 1800, this is one of the things I was doing hours of at a time, trying to get better, starting with ICC. And then when St. Louis started their broadcast, I was definitely watching that a lot of the time. So I've always really liked chess commentary, and I felt like it's a great way to improve just your general knowledge of the game and learning about different kinds of positions. Specifically about Peter Lecoq, recently he was doing commentary at the Greinke Super Tournaments this year, and I think the previous year, usually working with either Jan Gustafsson or I think Lawrence Trent did a few of them. And his commentary was specifically very good because he's played against all of the top players, and he has like these really, really interesting insights that he's very willing to share. So he's played against Aronian, Carlsen, Caruana, Vichy, basically, you know, everyone on the top circuit, Kramnik, obviously. And somehow when he's doing commentary, he's very good at like predicting their motives and just like analyzing their motives for this move. Because he's also a very active player, or at least I'm not sure how actively he plays, but he's actively studying openings. So he's looking at all the same Berlins and Italian games that everyone else is looking at. And a lot of times he's very willing to share his own insights and a lot of the opening discoveries he's made and contributions he's done. So in general, he's like a super player that's being extremely open with his like private like preparation work and his analysis. And it's especially interesting to see him analyze with Jan because they've worked together before. Jan was working as Peter's second. And so they clearly have a lot of experience like analyzing different positions together. And it really shows. Like usually I find the middle game analysis part somewhat uninteresting, because a lot of times it's the commentators either relying on engines and just giving the engine lines, or they're kind of like, they're just trying to demonstrate cute or interesting lines without really getting into the crux of the position. So I never found that part super, super interesting, at least not from a chess improvement point of view. But when Leko's analyzing, it's like a completely different picture. He's like really trying to get to like the truth of the position. And what's specifically useful for me is just seeing his intuition when he's analyzing different positions, specifically knowing like what kind of moves to calculate, because obviously they want to get to the answer very quickly for the viewers. And so if they start working, analyzing some line and it's not working, they'll think, okay, well, let's look at something else. Let's try this move. And for me specifically, the way he approaches the technical side of the game, I think, is really, really remarkable. Like, a lot of times he was just finding very clean solutions for converting, you know, advantages that for me were pretty instructive.
Huh. Yeah. And you mentioned you were not necessarily catching this live, but you were going back and watching it later, right?
Yeah. I mean, Chess24, I don't know if they still have them up, but they put the entire commentary on YouTube. So it's completely free, and I think it's incredibly useful.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I mean, Peter Leko, obviously, he still plays competitively, but he's also coaching this young German wunderkind, Vincent Kemar. So he's obviously still knows a lot about the chess world and an incredible resource. I echo your sentiment that people should check it out. Do you have other favorite announcers?
Yeah, I do speak and understand Russian. So I was recently listening to the Svidler and Miroshnichenko commentary in St. Louis, covering the St. Louis Rapid and Blitz, and I imagine they're doing the Sinkville Cup as well. But specifically, I really, really like Grandmaster Sergei Shipov as a Russian commentator. He's often working on his own, but I feel like his commentary is so fast and so on point that he's just as good as anyone else doing it. I think he's always been known to be a really good blitz player, so his speed of analysis is very, very, very good. And he's also well-known Russian coach. Like, he's worked with a lot of the top Russian players. So a lot of these guys, he knows like kind of personal info about them and their playing style. And, you know, he's just very, very familiar with all the players. So I really enjoy his work.
Wow. I did take Russian in college, but if I wouldn't be able to keep up, unfortunately.
But yeah. Same.
Yeah. So are you more inclined to watch English coverage or Russian coverage?
Yeah, it probably depends on who's doing it. If it's your average super tournament, I would probably go with Shipov, because I feel like he's I don't know. I think he brings like the most value in terms of like the Russian culture and the Soviet chess school and all that. But I definitely enjoy, you know, Jan and Peter when they're on Chess24 as well. I think they do really good stuff as well.
Yeah, they're quite entertaining and obviously know their chess. So it's interesting generally your perspective on watching broadcasting, because we've had other strong players on who always say like they'll check the positions, but they never have the sound on when they're watching. So, I mean, it's impressive to me that even up to the 2400 FIDE level, you're really benefiting from staying focused and watching. I mean, I guess as we've talked about with other guests, a lot of it comes down to like how much you're paying attention when you're watching.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it also is definitely used as a tool for procrastination if there's a big event going on.
Yeah.
I do feel like I get some real benefit out of it.
That's great. Yeah, because it is entertaining as well, as you mentioned. So have you been watching, I mean, we won't be too out of date since we're recording Friday and this comes out Tuesday. Have you been following the Sinkfield Cup much?
I have. I've mainly just been checking the games, but because it's like I'm back into a full work day, I don't have time to just watch the whole coverage. But I was watching the St. Louis Rapid and Blitz, and I'm definitely planning a Patreon post for some of the most interesting games from there. Cause I watched the whole thing and I thought it was like, I mean, some of the turnarounds and the swindles were really fascinating.
Cool. I'll look forward to that. What's your general take on Rapid versus Classical? Like, obviously we've had this again, I had this conversation with a lot of guests, but do you favor one over the other in terms of like what you like to watch?
Yeah, I definitely prefer watching Rapid events, mainly because there's, you know, more action and less time. But also just from like a theoretical standpoint, you know, you get to see more games and more openings. And it is very interesting to see how the players manage their repertoires during the events. Like you have someone like MBL who just plays the same thing every single game and people will test him. And then you had other players who are kind of bouncing around a little bit more, trying to, you know, just play different things. Especially like Mama Jar with White was playing like Knight F3, E3 every game and not really going for any of the main lines.
Yeah, I sort of feel like openings with White are trending in that direction. I don't know if mm-hmm. you caught MVL's quote that he's going to keep playing the Night Orph unless the doctor tells him to stop, but I enjoyed that.
No, I think it's been working for him, and it's like at this point it definitely feels like a point of pride for him to just keep playing the exact same lines.
Yeah. Yeah, and it makes the games more interesting for sure for the fans. So I hope he can keep it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you mentioned you're already busy. So, like, what work are you doing? Because for me, this is like one of my slowest work weeks because the camps are done, but the school year hasn't started. So all the after school programs I'm doing won't kick into gear for a few weeks. So what's keeping you busy this week, Kostya?
So one of the things I'm working on is just writing a couple articles about the trip for US Chess. So those will probably be going up sometime soon. I'm also working on some new courses for Chess University that I've done a lot of work for in the past. And yeah, now I have a bunch of private students as well that are planning their next tournament. So I'm trying to, whenever I have a long break with my students, when we get back into it, I try to, you know, construct some kind of new training plan or training regimen for them so that they can stay motivated going into the school year.
Good for you. Very, very dedicated teacher.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you do group classes for Bay Area Chess. Do those coincide with the school year or do they go year round or what?
Yeah, they're typically year round, and in the summer we might have one per month instead of the usual three. But these are the team classes at Bay Area Chess. Well, I think you had Judith talking about them in the past. So you probably know a little bit about them. But basically, I coach one of the groups now. Their rating level is about 1400 to 1800, which is a really cool bracket to teach because this is right where, you know, this is the time where they learn that, like, you can sacrifice a pawn without knowing exactly the concrete, you know, way you're going to get it back, but rather just for compensation. And they get to learn about interesting aspects of, you know, attack and defense and different openings and all that. And so I basically work with them until they can improve and advance to the elite team, which is 1800 plus. And then they get to work with Coach Daniel Naroditsky, who is really, really a great coach. Like he prepares some excellent material and he's very tough on them. So he really makes them work a lot. So it's kind of my job to prepare them for him.
Hmm. Is it like a good cop, bad cop thing? Or
Yeah, basically I'm just trying to get their like calculation up to snuff so that they're not embarrassing themselves too much.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm sure you're able to do that for the 1400 to 1800 students. And do you have like in that rating range, is there a common mistake you see, or is there like one thread that you see that the students really need to work on?
Yeah, I would say, I think I picked this idea up from one of Agard's books, but It's usually just not really looking for enough options. Because so many times, you know, you can put a problem on the board that's like maybe a 3 or 4 move combination. And then they can see, or they can intuitively figure out the first 2 moves. But then on move 3, they're not doing like the typical tactics check and looking for that quick mate in 2 or mate in 3. And so they end up missing a lot of these resources on move 2 or 3 of the variation. So a lot of times with calculation work is just like showing them, like, look at how many different options there are in the position. Because once they start like visualizing something, it's a lot harder, of course, to look at, you know, more variations. So it's just like a constant, like, it's just like a consistent training. Like, okay, here's like a bunch of positions. Try to calculate like very accurately. And of course, you know, finding the opponent's best defense is always a real struggle. You have to just remind them, like, you know, put yourself in your opponent's shoes. Like, after the sacrifice, like, you know, you have some candidate moves here. You can react a number of different ways. So just trying to get them to be a little bit more broader in their search when their calculation, I think, is the big one.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and definitely you can get tunnel vision the further down a variation you go. Okay. Well, Kostya, I think we've covered most of the things I had on my list. So what's next for your chess? Do you have any tournaments you're going to manage to play in over the coming months?
So right now I'm only planning one tournament for now at the very beginning of next year. They're going to restart the Bay Area International. So this is a tournament run by Arun Sharma a few years back, and now Bay Area Chess, I think, is helping him with it. So that will be a really strong event just right at the beginning of 2019.
Cool. Yeah, I think Judith mentioned that one as well.
Great.
Yeah, so that's a long way in the planning.
Yeah, other than that, I don't have too many events planned. I'm likely going to be coaching again at the World Cadet in November, and that'll be in Spain. So I'm pretty excited about that. And that's basically everything that's concrete for me. Other than that, just probably more courses, more videos, and hopefully more reading and training as well.
Yeah, I've got to make time for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we want you to get that title. We want you to get the GM title, Kostya.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And otherwise life is good. I mean, I know when we had you on the first time, you talked a little about how, you know, you weighed some other options, like, you know, pursuing improv or whatever, like working in the real rat race, and, you know, love chess so much that you decided to work as a professional. Are you still happy with that decision? It seems like things are going well for you.
Yeah, for the moment there's definitely tons of work coming in. So I would say being a chess player is really, really nice lifestyle. Get to make my own schedule and plan my own trips. And when I do travel for tournaments, obviously everyone I sort of work for understands, because they're all in the chess community. No regrets so far. You know, I always worry, like, what's going to happen in 20 and 40 years if chess will still be around. But, I mean, it survived this far, so I guess things are looking good.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, 1500 years and counting, still kicking. So yeah, I right. mean the overall popularity ebbs and flows, but it seems to never disappear despite proclamations that it might. Okay, yeah. Well that's a good night. I think that's a good note to end on. I think a lot of our listeners already know how to find you online, but in case they don't, let's give them the list.
Yeah, basically all my online handles are at Hello Kostya. So the easiest way to find me is on Twitter, or you can go to my site, which is simply hellokostya.com.
And if you Google Fide and Kostya, even though your name on Fide is listed as Konstantin Kovutsky, you still come up first as if you type in Fide and Kostya. So you've got that going for you as well.
Oh, good. Yeah.
But yeah, you can find his chess.com profile. He's on Twitter, Facebook, Chess University. Check out his Patreon page, his YouTube page. Not hard to track down. And Kostya is a great communicator of chess ideas. So for those of you listening looking to get better, I definitely recommend you check out his material.
Cool. Thank you so much, Ben.
Cool. Good to catch up with you. We'll be in touch.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Perpetual Chess. If you like the show, shout it from the hilltops. Tell your friends. Write positive reviews on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform. If you don't like the show, just keep it to yourself. I want to give special thanks to Geert Vandervelt for making the intro music. And of course, I have to thank my Patreon and PayPal Perpetual partners, without whom the show would not be possible. They are Adam Ralph, Adam Vrancoulge, Adrian Gutierrez, Andres Krizdwa, Alex Pejas, Brian Mullis, Carl LeBons, Chris Wainscott, Chad Hilton, Christopher Wood, Coach J's Chess Academy, Chris Flanagan, I am Christoph Zelicki, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, I am Alec Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortoris, Gary Andrews, Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jacob Agar, James Bonastia, Jennifer Valens, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Hartman, John Jernigan, Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Johnny McMenamin, WGM Katerina Nemkova, Kelly Palmer, Krishna Gopalakrishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Lorraine Dore, Matthew Passy, the producer of Perpetual Chess, Macaulay Peterson, Matthew Tedesco, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randall Temple, Ricky Grahova, Rob Lazorchek, Robert Steiner, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Victor Vrancoulge, FM Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks again, everyone. I will be back soon with another interview.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.